Jobs.com.
I made a bet on a product called Meep in 2015, and that failed. It was a very public failure for me, and that hurt. We made a bet from a milestone point of view, we decided to go and be profitable in the way we want to run our company. And it was hard, but I think fundamental shift in who we are today is because of the fact that we are very disciplined about how we build a company. We don't do crazy things, but we don't let anything impact us. For most parts, we are somewhere in control of our destiny now.
Hi, welcome to Pathbreakers. My name is Upendra and I'm your host for this episode. Our guest today is a gentleman who is very well known in India and for all the right reasons. Naveen Tiwari is a founder and CEO of Inmobi Group. He's an alumnus of IIT Kanpur and Harvard Business School. His professional journey began in McKinsey & Company, followed by a stint at Charles River Ventures. He is the founder and CEO of Inmobi, a platform enabling consumers to discover products and services on mobile apps and devices. A trailblazing company led by quite the trailblazer himself. And Inmobi is truly a global organization now with 19 offices across 4 continents. What we plan to do today in this conversation of Pathbreakers is we're going to try and understand Naveen a bit better, his leadership, what sets him apart, some of the bets he's made, and some of them have been really bold, his adventures in raising big-ticket funds from some of the leading marquee venture capital firms from around the world, and much more. So, Naveen, on that note, a warm welcome to Pathbreakers.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm pretty excited to be here.
All right, so Naveen, to kick this off, and I had to start with this question. So how did it really feel when the guys of the PowerPoint hit that $1 billion valuation, and I would imagine the first ones in India? What is that feeling like?
Oh my God. I would say we had no idea that there was a term called unicorn. And so when the first few people talked about it, we looked it up on the internet and, saw this horse with this thing on the nose. I was like, why are people calling us this? But I think jokes aside, I think it was good because, it was not something we had thought we'd get here so quickly, and so all the things that we were trying to do, and certainly trying to do that from India, it felt great. And the journey, 3 to 4 years that it took us to get there, almost seemed surreal, to say the least. And I think that whole feeling also kind of went away rather quickly because we were all on to the next goal and the next thing that we needed to go for. So I would say while it was a great moment for all of us and we did celebrate it, it had its shelf life and we had to kind of go and do many more things to make that count.
So did you get a chance to actually take a pause and print t-shirts with unicorns?
No. Thank God. Thank God.
All right. So Naveen, just to step back, if you could possibly just share a few moments with us explaining to us what really is the business proposition of Inmobi and what is it that your company is doing right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, Inmobi for a large part of its existence has been in the B2B software business. And so therefore, people may have heard of the company, but don't necessarily know what it does. And we also have evolved quite a lot, in the last 10 to 12 years of our existence and certainly evolved significantly in the last 2 to 3 years. So let me just kind of step back and kind of give you a high level picture on what Inmobi does. So today, as Inmobi Group, we have 3 companies that are part of our group. The first company is called the Inmobi Marketing Cloud, which is the business that we started off with in 2008. We have a second company, which is in the B2C space, one of the largest and the fastest growing, B2C platforms. It's called Glance. And the third business is in the data business. It's called TrueFactor. So we now have 3 companies. The Inmobi Marketing Cloud is an advertising and a marketing platform for marketeers out there in the world. And as we've all seen over the last many, many years, advertising dollars are shifting more onto digital and mobile platforms. And more enterprises are trying to essentially have access to software that they could manage their marketing and digital spends themselves. And that's what Inmobi Marketing Cloud does. The business is largely present across the globe, mainly in the US and China. And that's our largest business, very fast growing, very profitable. Very excited about that business. Glances, which is our second business, it's a B2C platform where we have built one of the world's first content platform right onto the lock screen. And our belief has been that, you know, with the advent of so much content out there in the world, with millions of apps out there, you know, there has to be a way in which all of that content can start to appearing right on the lock screen, such that, you know, we don't have to get into the phone for every time we are in the mode to discover something. And the platform has, in the last 12, 18 months, has grown phenomenally fast and large. And hopefully in the month of March, we will hit 100 million DAUs across India and Southeast Asia. So we are now in India, the third largest B2C content platform after Facebook and YouTube. And we are also very fast scaling in Southeast Asia. And we have broken into the top 10 B2C platforms in the world, ahead of Pinterest and just behind Twitter in wow. terms of daily active user base. So very excited about Glance in general. And the third business, which is called True Factor, it's our take on data. And our thesis in that business is that enterprises out there require data in the most simplified and structured form in order for them to make decisions, in order for them to be intelligent. If you look forward, the enterprises just need not just be enterprises in the next few years. They need to be intelligent enterprises. And so therefore, for those enterprises to be intelligent, they need data. And we have created a platform which is called True Factor that has APIs of intelligence that we have through our proprietary data. And the business is largely in the US. Early days, but very phenomenally differentiating. Very excited about that business also. So yeah, to summarize, we have three businesses now in Mobi Marketing Cloud, Glance, and True Factor.
Awesome. Thanks for that. And Naveen, if I may ask, so you have a unique business where you have a B2B business and you also have a B2C business. Was it a tough choice to make? And how does the organization cope with it? Because they're fundamentally different DNAs.
Right. Look, one is a, you know, media B2B business. Other is a B2C business. And third is an enterprise SaaS business.
Right.
And yes, all three businesses, by the way, have require very different skill sets. And I think there is a component around this where the way we think about this is, on one hand, we went after these businesses because something we had within InMobi Marketing Cloud that allowed us to create Glance.
Okay.
Similarly, our strength in InMobi Marketing Cloud allowed us to create True Factor. So they were not businesses that were like, you know, venture funded to begin with.
Sure.
But they had some linkage to what we were doing, which is an important aspect of how we thought about our businesses. That's one. Second, you're right, by the way, that these businesses require different skill sets. And so we have created three companies with people who are dedicated, you know, differently across three companies. Some of those people are always part of the group. And obviously we had to inject new blood to essentially bring in those perspectives. But I think at the core of it are three, four things which remain true irrespective of what kind of an organization it is. I think one is one has to learn to be able to put the customer at the center and then solve for that customer. So in the first business of InMobi Marketing Cloud, the marketeer is at the center.
Okay.
In the B2C business, the end user is at the center. In True Factor, you know, chief data scientist is at the center, right? So you kind of have to think about, you know, who is your customer? Are you serving that customer well or not? So that's one. Second, I think, is this whole piece around innovation and thinking about technology innovation as a way to build businesses versus anything else. And therefore, we do a good job of thinking about innovation very fundamentally. So that's now a part of our core thesis. Third is, you know, our ability to think, you know, global in any business that we do. InMobi Marketing Cloud is global. Glance is starting to go global. True Factor is global. So this whole thesis of being able to build a business with an IP using technology and then take that global is an important thesis. And the fourth one, which by the way is also very important, is partnerships. We are very good at doing very, very large, complex deals with large companies and enterprises across the globe. And whether it be at Microsoft or Samsung or Xiaomi and WPP, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we do a very good job of doing global partnerships with these large firms that allows us to essentially build, and we do these partnerships across the group, by the way, and allows us to essentially scale businesses very differently. So I would say those are our four key differentiating strengths that I think run across what we do and what we will do in future.
Wonderful. You shared quite a few things, and I'm going to pick up each of these in separate streams. The first off the block is, typically in any business conversation, when you say you're going up against a Google or a Facebook, there typically tends to be an apprehension when you're going up against the big boys. What kind of conversations did you and the team have when you were taking that conscious approach?
Look, entrepreneurship is not about, you know, being cautious in the beginning.
Sure.
And so in the beginning, you don't know why you're going after something, or, you know, you're not that thoughtful about it because you're trying to just survive and build a business.
Right.
It's only at a certain stage, mid-scale level, is you realize, all right, we are competing with the big boys out there. It's a good problem to begin with because you're now thinking of them as competition. And I think when you think of them as competition, tendency to essentially go after them in the same way that they go after the market is the last thing you want to do.
Correct.
And we tried not to do that ourselves when, you know, when we kind of built our business. So for example, we did two or three things that I thought were very different.
Okay.
One, you know, in the very early days, we realized that if you were to go directly to the US market, when we were starting to, you know, do international expansion, we realized that we would be going against the guys for whom this is the home market and the most important market that they're going after.
Right.
So instead of kind of going at the center of where the world action is, we actually went around everywhere else in the world before we went to the US.
Okay.
So we kind of avoided them and kind of built scale and momentum before we decided to enter the US, such that when we enter the US, we're not, you know, cut to pieces easily, but we can fight. And we've done that quite well. That's one. Second, we also realized that the very large enterprises out there in the world worry about Google and Facebook, right? They worry about, you know, how those companies are scaling and how over a long period of time, putting all eggs, which is the digital marketing spends, into their buckets would lead to increase in customer acquisition cost for each of these companies. So therefore, they wanted to work and be close to companies like us, which were very large, yet not as large. We could be great friends with these companies and work very deeply with them. And therefore, you would see us form these many partnerships that I talked about just, you know, recently. And that's why we do these partnerships. So point being, you, no matter what you're building today in the internet space, in the technology space, more likely than not, you're going to compete with one of the big tech companies out there.
Right.
And one has to figure out what your game plan is vis-a-vis them, which is kind of doing things differently from how they do it. And I think that becomes a very important playbook for you to succeed and succeed big.
Okay. What I want to do, Naveen, now is I want to go through the trajectory from your early days as M Coach to where you are now, right?
Yeah.
So my first off question is, M Coach, in my view, was a great proposition, maybe slightly ahead of its time or different factors needed to set in. Would you take another stab at M-Coach if you had a chance today from a directional proposition?
Well, M-Coach, what it was trying to do was to essentially make text messaging free.
Sure.
And the problem, and you know, obviously by leveraging advertising as an entity underneath that, such that those text messages are free. The thing that we were against two macro trends with M-Coach, by the
right.
way. The two macro trends that we were up against, one was that there was a shift that we could see where messaging would actually start to move the TCP/IP protocol.
Correct.
Versus the carrier interface, carrier protocol.
Sure.
And that meant that the cost of it would get subsumed within the cost of the access of internet.
Right.
That was one. The second was, even if it were to stay within the carrier stack, our success was dependent on carriers' decisions and movement. And their whims and fancies. And for the carrier, this was nice to do and not must to do.
Got it.
And you know, survival, there are so many startups that I know have, you know, shut because they relied on, they were on the mercy of a very, very large player.
That's right.
And that model doesn't succeed. And so therefore, we pivoted out of M-Coach and, you know, started in Mobi pretty quickly because we saw that that will not succeed. So, yeah, I don't think I would start and I would take the M-Coach proposition even if I were to do it again because fundamentally it wouldn't have succeeded.
Got it. So, of course, from M-Coach, you pivoted to InMobi and InMobi's evolved into the three business verticals that you mentioned now. But if I were to step back into the early stages, when did you and the team get that feeling that, hey, I think I've cracked this. I think I've got a business model. Was there an inflection point or a juncture?
You know, one of the things about entrepreneurship is that you are laden with self-doubt.
Correct.
And the self-doubt continues for a very long period of time.
Sure.
at every stage, you obviously feel happy about getting to that stage. I don't know when we really felt comfortable, because I think this discomfort is an important aspect of innovation, if you'd ask me.
Sure.
But having said that, I think the different stages, I will always remember the first financing we got, right? The Series A capital we raised.
Right.
Because it was a good validation for a bunch of us. It was a very small company then. That, look, we have created something where a venture capitalist is willing to back it. It was a big thing for us then. Felt that, hey, we may be onto something. It was clearly not a case of, hey, we have made it. You feel justified for the journey that you've done till then. And I think there are multiple such milestones that keep coming up where you say, all right, I've achieved the next milestone and the next milestone and the next milestone. And you feel happy about where you got to. But at the time you get there, you will continue to see the next one, which is significantly ahead of you, and say, look, that's where we all can get to now. So it's like a test match where you kind of play session by session, and you feel happy about that one session that you did well on, and then you kind of focus on the next session of the test match, right?
Correct.
And I think that's what we're doing, and we're still in day one of the test match. So the story still remains.
Okay. Since you mentioned milestones, right? Every milestone has a couple of bets which are placed before that. So if you were to look back at your journey, right, which is over a decade, which do you think were some of the bets or inflection points which you made, and possibly share with us a couple which worked and also some which possibly didn't turn out as well as you would have expected?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think very early on, we made a bet on that we are going to build the company from India.
Okay.
That bet was not necessarily supported by many people. I think that worked well for us.
All right.
And it was very pivotal, but it was very important bet that we made. We made a bet of building a global company and not just only focus on India, because India was going to be a small market and therefore you wouldn't have built a large enough company. Again, you know, building a global company and having a global thought process wasn't necessarily backed that well.
Right.
And people said, look, you shouldn't do it. But we still went ahead and did that. We launched in China against everyone's advice, and that's been a phenomenal success for us.
Okay.
We raised a round from SoftBank. You know, we decided to go berserk in terms of growth. We hired a lot of people. We kind of went crazy in terms of what we really wanted to do. We thought that we were going to own the world, and we were slapped back onto the ground because, you know, that's not how you grow companies. You have to be very systematic about it. So the bet of just like rapid growth through uncontrolled investments into every possible thing that may make sense, in even if somebody would pitch to me in a hallway, doesn't make sense, and you have to be far more systematic about these things.
Right.
I made a bet on a product called Meep in 2015, and that failed. It was a very public failure for me, and that hurt. We made a bet on from a milestone point of view, we decided to go and be profitable in the way we want to run our company, and it was hard, but I think fundamental shift in who we are today is because of the fact that we are very disciplined about how we build a company. We don't do crazy things, but we don't let anything impact us. For most parts, we are somewhere in control of our destiny now. We made a bet on Glance, and it was hard for people to believe that you can create another innovative thing within a large company.
Right.
I think we've created a phenomenal success out of Glance. And same goes for True Factor, where True Factor has been a great success and thing worked out for us. We made certain acquisitions. Some of them worked, some of them didn't work. So I'm going to stop there. But the point being, I think success and failure will keep coming in, I think, at all points of time. It took me a lot of time to convince myself that the output at times may not necessarily be, I don't control all the parameters of the outcome.
Sure.
I control a few of them. If I control a few of them, then that's fine. I shouldn't get too bogged down by the results. But that's very, very hard. And a lot of failures kind of give you that sense that, look, if you fail a few times, if you keep trying and do the right things, the success is going to be even bigger. So, yes, we have tried our bit and succeeded in some, failed in few. But the successes have been very large. So that's why it all makes sense.
Hey, that's great to hear. You did touch upon this. I just want to go a little deeper. So, why India? Because you, of course, had studied in North America. You'd also worked there. Why was it India?
I think it was more of a personal decision, I would say.
Okay.
I think, some of these things are not, you cannot be very objective about some of these things.
It happened, right? And it made sense. It was cool.
Yeah, it's just like, there is some logic of just being in India and that's it, right? If I were to put it on a piece of paper, there were more cons to being in India than pros.
Sure.
So the best decisions are not always the, you know, the ones which are most logical.
Okay. And Naveen, you mentioned two dimensions which I wanted to chat with you on. One was the dimension of partnerships and the other was international. You've been a successful company in opening up new markets and just not opening up, but being able to penetrate it and grow. If I were to ask you, what do you think you're doing right? And possibly tips for other guys who are trying to go abroad and strike it there, maybe in similar businesses or other businesses as well.
Look, I think when one thinks about global expansion, I think the first is just a mindset.
Okay.
Global mindset requires you to build things in a way that you don't necessarily have to see them at all points of time in action.
All right.
And that's why I say it's a mindset, because whether it's a team being out there, whether it is, you know, your product being out there, your customers, you're not seeing anybody or anyone, but you still have to figure out how do you create this mindset and have the trust that's required for you to essentially, you know, for an international operations to run.
Correct.
So first is a mindset. Okay. And it also, by the way, means that be okay in just flying in and out of different countries rather often. Be okay and comfortable with different cultures. All of those things kind of go in the first bucket.
Okay.
And the second one is the success. And this is my own learning, is the success of a market is significantly a function of the leader that you're able to get there.
Okay.
And you have no clue whether that leader will succeed or fail.
Sure.
You just have to get someone that you can and pray to God that will succeed for you. So literally it boils down to that one person who is out there. And third is, if you try to create significant amount of control through some kind of a central, you know, control command center kind of a thing from India or wherever it is, then also it's not going to succeed, because you have to give them the required space such that they could build what they are thinking about building, whether it's, you know, building the customer pipeline, whether it is, you know, going after someone else and going after, you know, what kind of culture they want to build, etc. So I think giving them their independence and space is important, and it goes all the way down to giving them eventually, not in the beginning, eventually giving them their own engineering teams, right? So
right.
It may not start there, but eventually gets there if they are successful.
So tell me something, Naveen. Every country it's got its own culture, right? How do you address something like that?
Look, I think it's a combination of two things. For example, if I think about the Mobi India culture, it somewhere comes together because of the Mobi culture and the culture of the land.
Okay.
The variability, when you go to, let's say, you know, China, for example, if I only created the culture of InMobi in China based on InMobi in India, then it's going to fail, because I've not been allowing for things to be, you know, how China is. It's the culture of the land. But if I also let it be completely be decided by the region of the country, then, you know, we're creating many InMobis, which may not be the right answer. So there is a hybrid there somewhere. Things that you're not negotiable about.
Okay.
You kind of have to be there and say and talk about them. And then there are things that you're somewhat, you know, flexible on. And I think we have tried to do that by bringing in local people and, you know, kind of telling them what broadly InMobi is, and then letting them decide how they want to build on that framework, how they want to build their region and culture. And so yet there is a broader connectivity, and while the local connect is maintained.
So just for us to get a sense, so currently how much of your business is coming from markets outside India, and how do you see that evolving over the next 3 to 5 years?
Look, for different companies, it's different. So okay. For example, for InMobi Marketing Cloud, that's about 92% or something like that comes right. from outside of India.
Okay.
For Glance, it's 80% India. For TrueFactor, it's 100% outside of India.
Wow.
So, you know, we have different companies in different phases, which kind of defines that level. And however you cut it, India is pretty central to us because we are based out of here, right? So that helps us.
Okay. The next, I want to move on to the consumer side of it. You're, in a sense, in the advertising business, in a sense. Would that be a fair way of looking at one dimension of it?
Of the consumer business? Or?
Yes, of the consumer business.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all.
That's a content business. But on the enterprise business, when you're looking at your B2B business, you're essentially allowing brands to connect with consumers on their mobile devices. I'm just trying to simplify it for a broader
audience. Yes, yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Right?
That's correct. In the enterprise business, that's what we do.
That's right. Now, this entire subject of consumers consuming advertising, be it resistance or looking at new formats and so on and so forth, how do you see that entire consumer trend evolving? And what are the kind of things which you think you're doing to kind of adapt to that?
Look, I think advertising plays a very critical role in the evolution of any medium.
Right.
Because obviously it kind of makes content, you know, available for, subsidizes content availability.
Correct.
Advertising in general, you know, needs to grow, and it is, by the way.
It is, yes. The numbers are skyrocketing.
Yes, absolutely. And the fact that basically essentially indicates the level of consumption that's happening, and the consumption is going up because consumers are consuming more and there is more content available out there. Now, that's clearly the mega trend. Now, there are obviously micro trends where consumers are, you know, going down the subscription of content path, et cetera, et cetera. So that's clearly happening.
Sure.
That's on one dimension. On the dimension of advertising, advertising is also becoming a lot more meaningful and mature in a way where the value add to the end consumer is becoming paramount importance. And so there is significant growth on both sides, but I think the dimensionality at which the digital medium evolution has been built because of advertising is clearly out there. And by the way, as you think about television in the future, linear television is going to go down. We'll see the rise of OTT players, and you'll see the rise of connected TVs and all of those things. And you now see all your mainstream also coming on digital through the same platform. So effectively, 7, 8 years, 10 years down the line, 80% of the world content would be subsidized through advertising, which is digital, and space is very large and evolving.
Good. So Naveen, from where you are right now in 2020, and if I were to ask you to look into the next 3 to 5 years, which are the top 2 or 3 trends, mega trends, whatever you may like to call it, which you are looking out for and saying, hey, maybe that's the next big thing? But I do know you have 3 very different business lines, so I'll give you the latitude of how you approach this.
Look, I think in our enterprise business of, you know, marketing cloud, I think the next big trend is television moving digital.
Okay.
So that's the big trend.
All right.
And I think the next decade will get defined by that. And that, by the way, unlocks whatever, like $300 billion worth of advertising pie to be captured, right? So that's why everyone is very excited by where the digital landscape is effectively moving. So that's on one bucket.
Great.
On the second bucket, as I think about consumers, to say that the consumption pattern needs to move away from an intent-driven consumption to a, you know, AI-driven predicted content consumption. So think about search.
Okay.
Search is all about intent-driven, you know, discovery of content, right? So I want to know about Paris. So I'll type in Paris, I'll get to know about it.
Right.
And that's fine. I think with the advent of content and the amount of data that exists, there has to be predictive content consumption that needs to happen. Yeah. And it needs to happen for like everything.
Right.
Every content that we're consuming. So there is that mega trend that, you know, and we are obviously participating in that, and we see that happening. And the third is around data and AI, where we have seen the power of AI in our own businesses, but we are a company which was born in digital internet era.
Right.
As you think about the remaining 99% of the enterprises in the world, which employ 99% of the employable human population out there, they cannot compete if they are not AI enabled. So democratization of artificial intelligence across every possible field and industry from an enterprise productivity point of view is required for sustenance of those companies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a mega trend that we're participating in for sure. So we'll see where that goes. So those are the 3 trends I would put up in a big way out there.
Awesome. So Naveen, now I want to move on to the next segment, which is basically picking up on one of the threads which has given you possibly a rock star status in India. your ability to raise very large amounts of funds and from, of course, some marquee investors. So if you could possibly share with us, what are the kind of things which you think have worked with you in your fundraise journey?
Look, yeah, so we've raised over $300 million or so as a company.
That's right.
The outset, I must say that raising capital is not necessarily a sign of success.
Sure.
It's actually not a sign of success. I think raising capital is just one of the early milestones, you know, so that, you know, you could do something. I think the things that have worked for us has been going after a big, big market.
Okay.
Right? Because every investor want to go back like a big opportunity out there. Right? So I think we're very bold in the kind of things that we go for. So that's really worked well for us. The second thing that's worked well for us is that we don't have a very capital intensive business models to ourselves, right? We don't have business models which require significant cash burns over a very long period of time, et cetera, right? So that's been an important thing. So we always have a line of sight of, hey, with this much capital, we'll be able to break even. And, you know, we'll have some numbers for it and we'll say, hey, with this much capital, we should be able to get to a break-even point. And it's a very important aspect for us. So people like that, investors like that, because they want to fund a company to get to the next stage and for that company to be self-sustaining. And so we always show that in our business plans. That's the second one. The third one is increasingly more and more, we have become very focused on high-margin businesses. To say we really want to focus and build on high-margin businesses because that allows you to essentially make mistakes along the way. And even if the business model kind of changes some dimensionality, the efficacy of the business does not go away. So for example, our marketing cloud business has a 40% gross margin, but Glance and, you know, Glance would be somewhere about 65, 70% gross margin.
Right.
You know, TrueFactor would be 70% gross margin business, right? So it's important for the businesses to be in that order for them to essentially scale them without having to worry about managing the last cent. So those are three things that I would say have worked really well for us.
Awesome. And tell me, Naveen, quite often many entrepreneurs, startups, teams which raise venture capital, and especially if they raise a large ticket size, there is a fair amount of pressure on the team in terms of delivering milestones and on some instances, possibly at a more accelerated pace than they would like. And I think this is common history now. Quite a few startups seem to be struggling in terms of meeting that pace. How have you managed to bridge that expectation to delivery to speed dimensions so that it's making sense for you and you're not burning?
You know, it's a very important question that you just asked. And I think if you think about it, I think at some point of time in the journey, it's a responsibility of the entrepreneur and the investors and the board to sit down and say, what metric are they going after?
Okay.
And the metric is very important. And I think the mistake that one makes is, and has been made in, you know, specifically in case of India, is that people have gone after, you know, vanity metrics. The way of achieving those vanity metrics is quite questionable.
Sure.
For example, acquisition of customers through discounting-based customer acquisition is not really a customer acquisition. It is, I don't know what it is.
Buying customers. Right?
It beats every human logic to justify customer acquisition through discounting. Now, if it were giving you something which is fundamental, go for it. But okay. I don't think it gave anything. And I think we have a scenario here where people are just talking about these vanity metrics without understanding the sustainability of those vanity metrics as they scale them 10x by burning 20x the money. So that is the problem. That's basically what's happening is you now have a hot potato on a hot potato on a hot potato and, you know, you're just kind of passing the hot potato on.
Sure.
And it's getting actually not, like, it's not getting cooler. The hot potato is not getting cooler. It's actually getting more and more hotter. And so you're in a tough spot. And I think it's the responsibility of the entrepreneur and the board and the investors to understand that it's not about the valuations. And I think the valuations in our country are a misnomer, because what one is not realizing is the stock price going up or not. So if you look at a bunch of companies where the valuation has gone up, the stock price not gone up. Right. That's not correct.
Okay.
If you look at a bunch of companies where cash to valuation ratio is sitting at like 70%.
Right.
And those are just not the right metrics, basically meaning your dollar is not working enough. If you think about the best companies in the world, like companies like Google, they raised about $125 million to get to where they are.
Correct.
So you don't need like disproportionate amount of capital to build great companies because you focus on innovation. And I think, well, are the companies focused on innovation or the companies focused on capital-led market capture in a non-unsustainable manner? Like, that has to be decided. And therefore, these large raises are not necessarily been great for the country and for the entrepreneurs in general.
You've also managed to create a fundamentally sound business, which, as you rightly said, is generating margins. I think you're operating profit break-even, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Correct. So my question to you is, was that a fundamental clarity that you and the team had right at the early stage that, hey, we do need to definitely work towards profitability? And the way that I'm seeing this as an outsider is you found the model to be profitable, and then you're raising a lot of money because now you're saying, hey, I know how to make money. Now I'm going to scale it, but I will continue my focus on making money.
There are two parts of this question. Okay. Let me try and answer them.
Sure.
Or let me answer them in two parts. So part one is we didn't have that clarity in the beginning. We learned it the hard way. And we learned it the hard way sometime in 2013 to 2015.
All right.
Because we were just going after vanity metrics. And soon the music stopped.
Sure.
And we had to step back and then realize that we need to own our own destiny in this playbook before we scale further.
Okay.
So we did that. We had a mindset change. We fixed things and we got them on track. And then we said, hey, now we know how to build businesses and business in the right manner. Here are two more businesses that we have built and scaled them to a certain level. Let's go and raise a little bit of capital for the next business so that we can scale and get it to, you know, profitability or sustainability in the right manner. And so therefore, we raised some money for Glance at the end of last year.
Right.
But we now exactly know what is required to raise capital and what is required to build a business. So now we have a predictable model of execution. That's, we think it's an engine here today.
Correct.
And that's become an important part of our culture on, you know, how do we drive predictable execution in a manner in which it is sustainable.
And I'm very tempted to ask you this question because one really can't ask us of too many entrepreneurial teams in India today. Since you have raised $300 million, let's say someone were to give you a $1 billion check today. How would you approach the growth and development of InMobi differently?
You know, a large capital creates a lot of pressure.
Okay.
Because the person who's put that capital in needs to understand how his or her capital is going to grow.
Sure.
And if there is $1 billion, then I must actually have a plan ahead of time that is doing something different. And that is a step change in my business model because of which I'll take that level of capital. Now, it could be to say, hey, if I raise $1 billion, I have to have clarity on those three things that I will do, which takes the business to the next level, which means maybe I would go ahead and do acquisitions, right? I would go and think about acquisitions and make them successful before I do anything else. I think the question also entails is that would I just, you know, try and grow the business by making the efficiency of my existing business haywire? The answer is no.
Sure.
And I think what's working for us is that discipline at execution level, which is very important. And by the way, if I didn't have a plan for the $1 billion, I would not take it.
I'm sure you wouldn't. See, I think what I was trying to get at is, so you basically have a couple of paths to take, right? One is you can say, hey, I'm going to do more of what I am doing. Or you might say, hey, I might just explore another market, whether it's organic or inorganic. So directionally, that's all that I was trying to get to.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. I think doing more of the same thing just by having more capital is not an answer.
Absolutely fair. Okay. Just on a lighter vein, it's been a fairly intense conversation, a very interesting one, but very intense. So let's say Naveen was given $1 billion to set up another business. Which would be the space that would excite you? And with your track record, I'm sure you can raise $1 billion. So maybe not too far off in the future. And we'll play this recording when you do raise that.
There you are. I think there is, there are things that one could do in the, so I'm a big fan of technology oriented businesses. So therefore, you know, the businesses that I might end up doing may necessarily be in the technology space. I don't know what exact space I may go in, but one of the spaces that excites me a lot these days is genetics and genetic engineering and genomes, etc. So I think clearly I would possibly go in that direction.
Okay.
And set up a business in that space. It's a right mix of biology, human science in one dimension and data science in another dimension, right? So, and I think the world's getting to a space where there is possibility of thinking about health in a completely different manner. So that'd be my big bet.
Awesome.
And, you know, today we have a lot of coronavirus you know, sentiments out there. A lot of those are a function of things that have gone wrong in, you know, in the way the world is functioning. So clearly there is a space for, you know, something like this.
All right. And now I want to move on to another dimension of Naveen as a leader, a manager, a colleague, a peer. So how's Naveen to work with?
I think I'm pretty chilled out.
Okay.
I'm not that bad. Not that people have told me so. The only thing I have is that most of the leadership team of mine has stayed with me for fairly long.
Okay.
So I'm sure I'm not that bad.
All right. So it's a good marriage there.
Yeah.
And how would you define Naveen as a leader?
I am very hands-off on one way. So I have a fundamental belief that great people can create things themselves. And as long as there is a vision lock, people will go ahead and do their things. And that's how I function and work with most people. I give them a lot of space.
Okay.
I fundamentally believe in the philosophy of having people at the deep end of the pool.
All right.
And the good ones, you know, swim out quite well. So.
And the others will float up for the wrong reasons.
Can help them out to go on the more shallower side.
Okay. And when you're hiring, what is it that you look for in talent? It's a very broad question. It's not domain specific, but what are those sparks? What's that thing, DNA, that you're looking for?
You know, one of the most important things for me personally at this stage that I seek and throughout I've looked for, some level is hunger.
Okay.
And, you know, that hunger is very important to us, is to say, look, are you ambitious? Are you looking to make something happen? Because all of us go ahead and achieve things not because we are capable. Skills are a commodity in today's world.
Right.
And so what's not a commodity is, you know, someone who has a hunger and ambition and has the will to make it happen.
Okay.
And that's what we try to seek and look for and, you know, hopefully we are correct sometimes and we're not correct sometimes, but there is no great way to figure this out. If someone has a hunger or not, like you either have it or you don't have it.
Okay. All right. The other challenge which many organizations, and this is not pertaining only to startups or MNC brands, and it's fairly universal now, is attrition and losing talent. And the spaces that you're operating in, which are digital, data, very niche skills in huge demand, technology, of course, product engineering. And pretty much I would imagine a good portion of your talent pool is in these high demand areas. So what's been working for you in terms of hiring and retaining talent and holding on to them and exciting them? What's your talent mantra, so to speak?
Look, I think these are all great metrics, you know, attrition, you know, retention, etc. But they're all output-driven metrics. And I think if you try to manage the output metric by doing something specifically for that metric, then, you know, it's not going to happen.
Okay.
The way we at least think about this is that you've got to build the right environment or the right culture and then let it be. And then, you know, just watch the magic. And so I think what we've done quite well, I'm very proud of it over the last several years, is really focused on building a great culture.
Okay.
A culture which is truly, I would argue, risk-taking. That's why we have created two more companies and a few more maybe to come. A culture that is, you know, significantly non-hierarchical. A culture where, you know, we look for people who can be entrepreneurial themselves and actually do things. And a culture where, you know, we don't try to manage people. And culture where the rules are the rules you want to follow, right? So we've tried to create that culture and an environment which I personally would like to be in. And I think it's working for us. And therefore, as a result, our attrition is low. As a result, our, you know, we get great people to come into the company. So I don't do anything to manage those metrics anymore at all. In fact, I don't even bother to look at them. I may get to see them, but I don't even bother to look at them. Because I know, in general, people are, you know, excited and happy about excited and happy about what they're seeing out there.
Awesome. And, okay, so I'm sure there have been bad days at work, right? Some bet hasn't paid off, something hasn't worked out, and it's major. So what do you do to basically pick yourself up again?
Look, man, it's not easy. It's not easy. I think it is very, very hard, you know, when the big bets don't go your way, because it becomes very public and, you know, nobody likes to fail publicly specifically.
Sure.
And
so how do you shake it off? Do you go for a run? What do you do?
I think there are a few things that I do. I think one is the people close to me at home and at the workplace really help out, because you can talk to them and you can tell them what you're really going through. That helps.
Right.
Not that anybody can do anything about it, but I think that really helps.
Sure.
You know, certainly hitting the gym helps, because that kind of gets you out of that zone a little bit. But I think that the thing that's really worked well for us is a handful of us will get together on the whiteboard immediately and say, we will not leave till we now have the next solution.
Great.
And I think we're very problem-solving, solution-oriented people. And, you know, you kind of bring yourself back up the minute you see the solution coming together. So no great answer there.
No, sure.
I think people around you really help you come out of these things, and you kind of are back onto your...
See, I think what you mentioned is you've hit the nail on the head, right? I think all of us go through this. It's important to have a set of social people around you whom you can at least have a chat with. I've seen many people who go into their individual shell and even go fairly extreme. So I think what you've said is natural. It's about chatting about it, talking about it. And what I really liked is where you left it off, saying, hit the whiteboard, start from scratch, and nothing about chatting about it with the guys.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, so Naveen. So it's been a fairly intense discussion. So we have a segment called the Rapid Fire.
Okay.
I'm sure you've seen Coffee with Karan.
Yes.
All right. So awesome. But we do things a bit differently. Even if you get really fabulous answers, you don't get a coffee hamper.
That's a good incentive.
All right. So it's just fun just to get to know you and just like let your hair down. All right. So
all
just
right,
go with
right.
it.
I hate these.
All right. All right. I love starting off with this one. So first crush.
Cars.
Your first crush. Seriously, cars.
Yes. I loved cars.
Okay, you're getting... All right, we need to move on to the politically correct
zone. Just to be clear, first crush is my wife now, so...
Okay, this is getting extremely politically correct. All right, we will try and maneuver this.
I met my wife in grade
okay.
5.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's why I'm not politically correct with this one. I'm actually factually correct now.
Oh, this is really sweet and touching, and we're going to do another podcast on that one for sure. Okay. All right, mountains or beaches?
Beaches.
Your best book?
Lifespan. By Dr. David Sinclair.
Okay, I must pick that up. Favorite movie?
Oh my God.
Or the one which comes top of your mind. So, what do you like going back to?
Awesome!
So, there is a true romantic. So, there is a grade 5, met the wife, and there is a DDLJ.
I did watch this movie with her.
Oh man, this is like strike 3. Okay, awesome. There is definitely a podcast coming. All right, your preferred drink?
Red wine.
Bungee jump or coffee?
Coffee any day.
Seriously? Okay. You raised $300 million. I think you owe yourself a bungee jump. Okay. Long term or short term?
Long term.
Culture or process?
Culture.
That is coming. Awesome. Play safe or go for broke?
Go big or go home.
Awesome. Your winning mantra?
Winning mantra is be bold and ambitious.
Great. What gives Naveen a thrill?
Being bold. And, okay. You know, creating things and doing things that have not been done before.
Awesome. And what ticks you off?
Negativity.
All right. The most exciting innovation of recent times?
Of recent times? Nothing coming in.
No
worries. Nothing coming in.
Okay. The one thing you wish you could disrupt?
Health.
Health. Linked to your response in genetics.
Okay. Yeah.
You can see it's fairly clear. The one thing which never really fails to give you goosebumps?
Talking and doing something for the country.
Great. The most impeccable failure of recent times?
pass on that one.
Yeah, sure. The main ingredient for success?
The, you know, ability to see things that others cannot see and be able to lay down the path to get there for people to be able to then visualize it and then have the ability to win. And I know it's a long-winded answer to your question, but I think that's the that's important.
No, it makes sense. Describe Naveen 2.0. So let's say there is in Mobi, there is a day when you say there is a Naveen 2.0. What comes to your mind, top of mind?
I am much more bolder.
Okay.
Much more clearer.
All right.
A lot more focused on people.
Okay.
And culture. And the desire to win is even more now. So I'm hungrier.
Great. And would you make a sequel to DDLG if you had the time?
Yes.
Who would you cast in it?
That's a good question. I'm actually very bad with the more recent actor and actresses. So
no worries.
I would pass on that piece, but I would certainly make the sequel.
Awesome. And the last one. What would your professional epitaph read like?
You have one life. You've got to dream. You know, you got to dream and make things happen.
Awesome. All right. So Naveen, on that note, amazing chatting with you. Extremely sharp insights. Great stuff. Great journey. You're truly the rock star. And I'm sure you have several more successes coming along your way. And you will take many more challenges. It's been awesome having you on the show. Thank you so much, Naveen.
Thank you so much. And I truly enjoyed this. It was very, very fun. Avaaz.com.